What is going on, all you constant listeners out there in the multiverse? I hope you are doing very well. As a reminder, if you like this podcast, you can follow the podcast on Twitter at the Earth16 Podcast. You can also follow it on Instagram at the Earth16 Comics Wire to get more updates on the podcast and future episodes. You can also follow me on my personal Twitter at Brian of Earth16, and you can follow the Instagram at Brian of Earth16 as well. So I have two accounts that you can see updates on. And the podcast also has its own TikTok account, so you can follow that Earth16 Comics Wire. And hopefully I can add more sound bites, I can add from our episodes, and just so that way I can give you a sneak peek to what's coming up. And podcasts can also be listened to anywhere, in addition to Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and I'm also putting episodes on YouTube. So if you're listening to this, you can catch my podcast on any platform. So, like I said, I hope all of you are doing well and awesome. And just as an update, I'm going to be doing commentary on Black-themed comics all this month to celebrate Black History Month. Itcog Negro, the comic that I'm doing for this episode is one of them. The comic was written by Matt Johnson and Warren Pleece. And I'm also going to be covering Itcog Negro Renaissance, which is also written by Matt Johnson. And I'm also going to be covering the graphic novel Showtime at the Apollo, the epic tale of Harlem's legendary theater, which was written by Ted Fox and illustrated by James Otis Smith. So I'm going to be doing a lot of commentary on those to celebrate Black History Month. And also in addition to that, I'm going to be doing future episodes and commentary on Osamu Tezuka and Spider-Man Clone Saga. The only reason why I haven't gotten around to doing those is because I've been pretty busy, but those are going to be posted in the future. So be on the lookout for those. Hopefully, I would say maybe within the next month of March. And even furthermore, I'm going to have Pat Murphy back on the podcast to discuss his comic, The Echoes of the Triumphant, which I think is a really cool comic. And it's about a man who is an MMA fighter, and he's on the rise to stardom. But then that pretty much gets put on hold when a freak accident happens in the city that he's living in and creates people with mutant abilities. And he has to navigate through that. So we're going to have Pat back on to talk more about his comic, which is right now on Kickstarter. And it's a really amazing comic. I recommend if you read it. And I recommend, too, if you go to the Kickstarter site and look it up, it's Echoes of the Triumphant. When I come back, I'm going to be giving you my commentary on the graphic novel Itcog Negro. Like I said, it's written by Matt Johnson and it's illustrated by Warren Pleece. And the comic is about an African-American man who's light-skinned and poses as a white man to infiltrate and report on the lynchings and the injustices in the Deep South. When we come back, we're going to get into Itcog Negro. You don't want to miss this, folks. Welcome back, constant listeners. Now I'm going to go straight into my commentary of Itcog Negro. So Itcog Negro was written by Matt Johnson, the artist was Warren Pleece, and the publisher was DC Comics under their Vertigo imprint. And the synopsis of the comic is that the Itcog Negro is a story of a light-skinned African-American reporter who poses as a white man to expose racism and corruption around him. And the story also is about this reporter who was originally going to quit being a reporter because of how dangerous the job was getting, but then he relents after it's revealed that in his next assignment, he's going to have to report on his brother getting lynched, and that changes everything for him, and that he makes it his mission to not only report on the event, but to also rescue his brother from being lynched. So what really got me hooked into the story was just that it was inspired by It was actually inspired by Walter White, who was an African-American journalist who could pass for a white man due to his light complexion. And journalists like White reported on racial injustices in the South. And another thing that the reason why I was also inspired by the story was because I am an aspiring writer myself, and I was moved by the tale of an African-American using his complexion, especially posing as a white man, to expose racial injustice and to educate the public about what was going on, especially in the Deep South. And the character of Zane Pinchback, Pinchback is the one I feel I can relate to because, like Zane, I'm a biracial African American. My mom is white and my dad's Nigerian. Whereas with Zane, his dad was white and his mom was black. And I feel that, like Zane, I've lived in between two worlds. What I mean by that is just that while I believe that the United States is a great country where, given the opportunities, we can be whoever we want to be as long as we put our mind to it, I've also experienced another version, a dark side of where that experience echoes our country's dark past with racism. So that's what I mean by the two worlds. And I can definitely show you some personal stories of my brush with racism. My first brush was when I was a young kid in elementary school. And in the neighborhood, I made friends with a group of kids who were actually pretty cool, but except only one kid in particular. For some reason, he and I just didn't like each other. And he started calling me black person. And I was really kind of scratching my head. And I was pretty surprised too. Like, why would he be doing this? Because I thought, you know, in elementary school, I learned all about Martin Luther King and how he wanted every one of us to come together, black and white, and people of all other races. But then here's this kid who apparently seemed to like not learn from that history, calling me black person. And it's like, you know, we don't live in those times anymore, right? You know, times have changed. That's what I initially thought when I was a kid. But now that I'm older, I found out that, you know, I've actually found out that it was probably just ignorance and that he didn't know any better. And even this is, mind you, I lived in San Diego, California. And California, you know, even around that time was like considered like the progressive bastion of the United States. And this wasn't going to be the last time that I had a brush with racism, because I had another brush when I was a teenager in 10th grade back in, again, this is back in San Diego, California, Mira Mesa, to be exact. And I was on my way. So one afternoon, I was on my way back home from a friend's house running my bicycle. And I see these two Filipino boys that I knew from my ROTC class. And as I'm riding my bike, I notice them. I just nod my head and saying, what's up to them? And they're like, what's up, N-word? And I completely hit the brakes on my bike and I froze. And I just looked at them like, you know, you didn't call me what I thought you just called me. That's basically what was going on in my mind. Like, what the heck? And they just looked at me with smirks on their faces, thinking it was funny, you know, and I kind of played it off too, like, oh, you know, but deep down I was offended. And I confronted them later on about it. Think about a week ago or so, I think, around that time. And I just confronted them, like, you know, dude, what you did was like really jacked up. And they were like saying, oh man, we were just joking around, man. Stop, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da. I'm like, no, what you did was really jacked up and you better apologize. And again, this is coming in from California. And my third brush was that about 2 years after that, or a year or two after that, I encountered this white dude and this white girl who said, just casually said, what's up, N-word? And it was alleged that they had some ties to white supremacist groups in Marietta, because around that time I moved to Marietta, California. And these two were alleged to have ties to white supremacist groups in Marietta, in the area. And one of their friends, actually, now that I remember, even threatened to harass this security guard, the school security guard of Latina descent, and said he was going to put Confederate flags all over her stuff and just all this crazy stuff. And I'm just like sitting there seeing that, you know, does this dude even understand what he's saying? And it was just real. It was a real experience. And I was like, wow. And it made me realize that, you know, that racism is alive and rampant. I mean, that's just what it is. And we have to acknowledge that. We have to acknowledge that there was a dark side. You know, that's the dark side of the United States, that we had a brush with racism. And, you know, I think for us to come together, we need to acknowledge and understand that. And I think that's what writers like Walter White had in mind when they were going out there risking their lives to expose the injustices going on in the Deep South and other places where it was happening. And we also have to acknowledge other event, other injustices as well, like the Tulsa Race Massacre, placing Native Americans in reservations, the segregation, the internment of the Japanese during World War II. The list goes on. I mean, this is real stuff that we have to acknowledge. And I think that the bravery of journalists like Walter White is one of the many reminders of that we need to acknowledge the good and the bad. Because how else is everyone going to know? How else is everyone going to know if we don't talk about it and educate people? So that's my say on the whole thing. But going back to Inca Negro, I want to discuss with you the characters of the story. And the first character being Zane Pinchback, and he's loosely based on Walter White. As I mentioned before, he was a journalist who posed as a white man to report on the lynchings and injustices in the Deep South. So Zane Pinchback's an African American who has light skin. And the story, in the beginning of the story, it starts out with him doing an assignment on the lynching that he's witnessing. And if you look at the images too, or the art, you can just see the black man getting a black man getting lynched, and it's really graphic. And they dress him up as a clown, and because apparently he was a soldier, and they went after him and lynched him, and this is really a humiliating way to go and a humiliating way to die, a really sad way too. And Zane just reports on the event, pretends that he's a white man to make sure that he blends in so that way no one catches him. But then he ultimately somehow gets caught, and they start chasing him, and he narrowly escapes. And it's at this point where the Harlem Renaissance is happening, and Zane wants to make a name for himself during this movement. And the Harlem Renaissance, for those of you who don't know, is a African American intellectual movement that involved artists, politicians, writers, film, involved a lot of influential African Americans of the time during like the 1920s and 30s. And Zane wants to make a name for himself during that time, but the one thing that grabs his attention, because he originally wanted to quit doing the reporting of the lynchings under the name Inca Negro, which has become pretty legendary throughout the country because people have read his stories. But what changes his mind is when he finds out that his brother is sent to be lynched in the town of Tupelo, Mississippi. So he quickly takes a train ride to Tupelo to help get his brother out. And which brings me to the next character of Alonzo Pinchback, aka Pinchy, Zane's twin brother, who is said to be lynched for being accused of murdering a white woman by the name of Michaela Mathers. Alonzo is a lot darker than Zane, and it's revealed that he did not kill Michaela. And as a matter of fact, Michaela is his lover, and they were working on making moonshine together. And in a much bigger twist, Michaela is revealed to be alive. But she faked her death to avoid paying off the debt which she owed, and to get the people who are after her off her trail, which further complicates things because initially Zane wants her to turn herself in and tell the sheriff of the town that there was a mix-up. But she doesn't want to do it because she doesn't want to end up paying off debt, and she doesn't want people going after her. And Alonzo is devastated at the fact that his girlfriend, initially seeing the body of the dead white woman that he mistakes for his girlfriend. And there was a scene too in the comic where he's recalling the events of how he came across the dead body and the fact that he was so distraught that he didn't fight back when the cops arrested him or when the police arrested him. And with Michaela, the next character I'm going to mention, like I said, she's Pinchy's white girlfriend and partner in their moonshining business. So she kind of distorts her narrative at first. I mean, she says that she too came across a body of a dead white woman, and since they looked alike, she decided to use that as an advantage to make it look like that she died. So she puts her clothes on the dead white woman, so that way she can get away with it. And so it would make it look like that she did it, or no, excuse me, that she died, when in fact she didn't. But this backfires on her because she gets her lover, Alonzo, in trouble. And even furthermore, it turns out later on that the white woman that was killed was posing as a white man, a deputy, because she even said that, you know, to throw people off their trail. She tells Zane later on that she said that the deputy, she initially tells him that the deputy might have killed the white woman and ran away from town. And this gets Zane to take her off the trail and to go to the white woman's family. This is where it gets really interesting, because Zane initially wanted to get the lead on the deputy who he initially thought killed the white woman. But in a twist, it turns out that the white woman was posing as a deputy, the dead white woman, and her name was Frances Jackson White. And they initially thought Frances was the guy, but it turned out that it was a girl, and it led him to realize that, oh shoot, like, that woman was actually named Frances, because even her father reveals that Frances was a girl. And then later on, it's discovered that Michaela killed Frances because she thought Frances was sneaking up on her moonshining business. And when she reveals to the sheriff that happened, because the sheriff, here's another thing too, the sheriff was having an affair with Frances, who was a deputy, a secret affair. And when Michaela reveals that she killed Frances, the white woman, and used her body to fake her death, the sheriff kills Michaela out of revenge. And Alonzo at this point is already devastated by the fact that, you know, he thought Michaela died, though, but then to see her alive, he got pretty angry with her. But then when she and the sheriff kind of struggle in a tussle after after Michaela's confession, Alonzo tries to save Michaela, though, but only for her to get shot by the sheriff. And the sheriff initially says that he wants to let Alonzo and Zane go, since there's been enough violence as is already. But Zane does, and this is towards the end of the story, so Zane, in a clever way, tells the sheriff, like, okay, you can let us go, though, but under one condition, or under several conditions, actually. I need you to reveal the names of the people involved in the lynchings, because in the story also, and this is a spoiler alert, mind you, in the story, Carl, another character I'm going to mention, is Zane's best friend, who could also pass for white, but he does it in a way that is a little self-interesting. Like, he's in for his own self-interest. He's a bit of a swindler and a card player and a smooth operator. So when they're on their way to Tupelo, Mississippi, Carl does like several fake accents, including a fake Southern accent and a fake British accent. So he poses as an Englishman to get with the townspeople, to get, you know, to earn their favor and all that. And this initially works because he's able to help provide Zane with information on his brother's whereabouts and about what they're going to do to his brother. And but ultimately this backfires when the people of Tupelo discovered that he's actually African American descent. And they end up actually lynching him because they think that he's the one who's Ikhok Negro, not Zane. So they mistake him for Zane, and they lynch him, and he dies, which causes Zane to break down. So Zane tells the sheriff, like, okay, so, you know, you're gonna give me the names of the people who are involved in my best friend's lynching, and also, you're gonna also have us take my friend's body back, because if you don't do this, then I'm gonna have to report on the fact, because he's a journalist, mind you. I'm gonna put out an article stating that you had an affair with a deputy who was posing as a white man who's actually a white woman. So the sheriff acquiesces to his request, and toward the end of the comic, Zane and Alonzo are able to return to Harlem, and Zane's able to get his job as a managing editor, because initially, remember, he wanted to quit and wanted to make a name for himself. But he was given the position of managing editor, and he finally reveals his Ikhok Negro moniker to the world. But he does it in such another clever way, where he reveals Mr. Huey, the antagonist of the comic, as Ikhok Negro, because Mr. Huey is one of the antagonists who is behind the lynching of Carl. And also, in the beginning of the comic, he's the one who spots Zane escaping from them. And so in the end of the comic, Zane reveals Ikon Nigger as Mr. Huey, since, you know, keep in mind, the character of Ikon Nigger is a black man who poses as a white man in order to gain information. So when Mr. Huey is revealed as Ikon Nigger, the people start to go after him because he's just kind of confused, like, why is everyone going after me? Like, well, because you're Ikon Nigger. It says here on the newspaper. And that's how the story ends. And then another antagonist I wanted to mention was Seamus Jackson White, who is the father of Frances Jackson White, the woman who posed as a deputy, and also the woman who was killed by Michaela and was used by Michaela to fake her death. So overall, I mean, this was a noir. It was a noirish mystery, and that's one. I think that's another reason why I enjoyed the comic. And also, it again talks about racial injustice and how one man used his features to actually infiltrate these lynchings and to also expose racial justice, which I think is really awesome. And using the moniker Ikon Nigger, so I thought that was really cool. So having said that, when I return, I'm going to be doing some commentary on Matt Johnson's writing. And I'm also going to be doing commentary on Warren Pleece's art. So you don't want to miss this, folks. We'll be right back. Welcome back, constant listeners. Right now, I'm going to be discussing with you Matt Johnson's writing and Warren Pleece's art. Matt Johnson's work has appeared in several platforms. He's written two novels, including Loving Day and Pym. He's also a professor at the University of Houston. His graphic novels also include Dark Ruin and Right State. So in the author's note, he talks about how Ikon Nigger came about, and it's a really interesting story about how it happened. It's a really fascinating story, actually. And here it says here, and I quote on the author's note, "I grew up a black boy who looked white. This was in a predominantly African-American neighborhood during the height of the Black Power era, so I stood out a bit. My mom even got me a dakashi, or dashiki, so I could fit in with the other kids, but the contrast between the colorful African garb and my nearly blonde, straight brown hair just made things worse. Along with my cousin, half black, half Jewish, I started fantasizing about living in another time, another situation where my ethnic appearance would be an asset instead of a burden. We could go incognito, we told ourselves as we run around pretending to be race spies in the war against white supremacy. I forgot my Ikon Nigger dreams until college, when I read about Walter White, the former head of the NAACP. White was an African American, even paler than I was. In the early 20th century, White went undercover, posing as a white man in the Deep South to investigate lynchings. It was as if my little childhood fantasy had come to life. From then on, the idea continued to gestate. I started feeling that what once seemed silly was turning into something I had to write about. The birth of my twins in 2005, one of whom is brown-skinned with black afro hair, and the other with the palest of pink skins and more European curly hair, brought the rest of the story home to me. Two people with the exact same ethnic lineage destined to be viewed differently only because of the genetic randomness. From there, the story found itself, and now it finds you." And I found that his writing was, I enjoyed his writing on this comic. It, to me, it talked a whole lot about race and how detrimental it was, and that, and just like how detrimental race was. And the style had a lot of noir vibes, especially with the dialogue and the narration. And I want to talk about the narration too. on the lynchings and injustice. And he's using, pretty much he's writing about Zane's narrating of the events. It says here that between 1889, and I quote, Zane narrates between 1889 and 1918, 2,522 Negroes were murdered by lynch mobs in America that we know of. Now, since the beginning of the 30s, most of the white papers don't even consider it news. To them, it's another N-word dead. It's not a story. So my job is to make it one. That's all. And you can't. Right now, Zane's talking to his friend Carl and Carl's girlfriend. And Carl's girlfriend says, "You can't stop there, Zane. Tell me more. Did you try to stop him? Did you try and stop him?" And Carl says, "Mildred, darling, this is not really a discussion for the lady, but by the time I show up, the man is already long doomed. After they beat him near to death, they usually cap it off with some ritual demasculation." "Don't you mean emasculation?" "I've said too much. These horrors are outside the female mind." So they're continuing the narration, which is in the form of a conversation. So Zane continues to narrate. After that, like house cats with dead mice, they tend to play with the body, particularly if it was a soldier. Crackers hate to see a uniform on a soldier. They usually strip those guys first. And then Mildred comments, "Soldiers? That means those boys are patriots. What would they rather have them wear?" And Zane responds, "They have other uniforms in mind." And the commentary, along with the art done by Warren Police, it just shows KKK members hanging this poor black man, and they dress him as a clown while he's being lynched. And Zane continues, "After that, it's a memento time. They take pieces of the body as keepsakes. Pictures are taken to remember the special day." And in this scene, this is Zane's recalling his near-death experience as he's exposing these lynchings. He's doing reports on them, gathering notes in all kinds of details. And there's a splash of him also just writing the reports down, his accounts of the events happening. And he even says here too in the narration that Mildred asks him, "How do you keep them from discovering you?" And Zane asks, "That I'm a journalist?" And she says, "No, that you're really a Negro." And Zane says, or responds, "Oh, that, I just don't stay long enough for those crackers to figure it out. At least I try not to get caught, but sometimes." Then Mildred asks, "What do you do then? What did you do this time?" And then Zane responds, "I did what any self-respecting colored man would do in any situation, or in the situation." And it shows a art of him just trying to play it cool, but you can tell he's nervous. And he responds, "I ran. Like beige lighting going downhill, I ran." And then Carl says, "Sorry to interrupt your chat with my girl Zane, but now I must jump in. Now you just bragging." And Mildred says, "Carl, stop. What happened? How did you get back to Harlem safe?" And as Zane is narrating, it shows an art of him just running away from the main antagonist, Mr. Huey. And he says, "I just got lucky." "That I don't believe," responds Mildred. And then Carl says, "I do, honey. The way I am with cards and the ladies, Zane is with life." And Zane responds, "Carl's right, Mildred. I am stupidly, impossibly lucky. That's why I can't be doing the stuff no more." Joking aside, Zane, what you do is a great service to our people. You're just not passing for white to get a table at the Waldorf Astoria. "Now, honey, I take offense to that. Can a black man eat a Waldorf salad without being branded a race traitor? You gotta admit, slick, you got skill for avoiding the devil." Then Zane responds, "That just means that now that the devil's out there looking for me." And it shows Mr. Huey just grimacing and looking on as Zane escapes. And the one thing the major things I like about the writing is just that the dialogue is clearly distinct in the difference between the characters by the way Zane and Carl speak and the way that Alonzo, Ryder, and Michaela speak. And that distinctness creates some chemistry between the characters with a fun yet serious banter, even with the sheriff and other characters too as well. And you see a lot of this with Carl doing his mock British accent, his mock Southern accent. And yeah, we see a lot of that. And we even see with Alonzo, with the way he speaks, like I said, it's very different from Zane. Whereas Zane, it's more eloquent, but Alonzo, there's a lot of slang there. And of course, the use of the N-word too. I mean, it has to reflect, what was going on in the story and everything, and the whole theme of it, just exposing racial injustice. And another thing I liked about the writing was the whole narration of Zane again, talking about like how he's Ica Negro. And I quote, "He describes himself as, 'I am Ica Negro. I don't wear a mask like Zorro or a cape like the Shadow, but I don a disguise nonetheless. My camouflage is provided by my genes, a product of the Southern tradition nobody likes to talk about. Slavery, rape, hypocrisy. American Negroes are a mulatto people. I'm just an extreme example, a welcome reminder. Since white America refuses to see its past, they can't really see me too well either. Add to that a little of Madame CJ's magic and watch me go invisible. Watch me step outside of history." So you see the art of him just getting dressed, getting ready as Ica Negro. He's curling his hair to make it look straighter. You see also a silhouette of the American flag in front of him as he's talking about his being Ica Negro and just how white America refuses to see its past and how and its analogy of them not seeing him too well either. They see him as a white man because of his pale complexion. And Zane says assimilation as revolution. And he also continues by saying how race is a strategy. And I quote again, he says, "That's one of the thing that's one thing that most of us know that most white folks don't, that race doesn't really exist. Culture, ethnicity, sure. Class too. But race is just a bunch of rules meant to keep us on the bottom. Race is a strategy. The rest is just people acting and playing rules. That's what white folks never get. They don't think that they have accents. They don't think they eat ethnic foods. Their music is classical. They think they're just normal, that they are universal, and that everyone else is an odd deviation and from form. That's what makes them so easy to infiltrate." In a sense that, their own bigotry is, he's also saying too, I think that their own bigotry or their own arrogance or the way they see themselves as standard, as normal, is their sort of their Achilles heel, because he, as a pale-skinned black man who could pass for white, could easily understand that. He could actually see that. He can actually read that. And the part especially where he says that that's what white folks don't get, like the fact that the rest of people acting playing roles and race being a strategy and thinking that they don't have accents and they don't eat ethnic foods and that their music is classical and then them just seeing that they're normal. It reminds me of what my sister likes to call the colonizer mindset, where everything that they do, white people is just a norm. When in fact, there's different approaches to life that some people, from different cultures undertake. It's not, there's really no standard way of living, in other words. It's just people live in different ways. And sometimes it can be argued that there's some, people who want people to live a certain way when in fact the way that they grew up in is starkly or drastically different from the way that they grew up in. And colonizer mindset, one can argue is just that, oh, this is the standard way of living. This is the standard way of eating, standard way of doing everything. But people who grew up in a different culture may think otherwise. Like, no, this is actually the way I live, or this is how I see that. So it's basically it's different perspectives, is what I'm trying to say. So that's what the writing kind of reminded me of. And another thing I wanted to mention too with the writing was just that the flashback scenes with Alonzo and Michaela, and how like the words alone just reveal what happened. I mean, you don't really, I mean, with the art, this complements it as well, but even if you heard the words alone, like you can definitely see like what happened. And I'll quote, and this is Alonso talking when Zane visits Alonso in jail, and he talks about like how he encountered the dead body of Michaela when it wasn't really Michaela. He just encountered the dead body of the white woman, Frances Jackson White, who he thought was Michaela. So Alonso narrates that nothing to tell. There I was on the hillside about 4 miles from town, minding my own, just walking through the woods on a little nature stroll. And then Zane tells him to stop. Look, you like nature about as much as you like taking a bath. Cut the shit and tell me what's going on so I can help you. So he says, okay, fine, sorry. And this is Alonso continuing. So I've been setting up a still out on that little hillside, regular Tennessee-style moonshine like Uncle Jim taught me. I met the love of my life, Michaela Mathers. The deceased white woman, Alonzo? Zane asked. The love of my life, Zane. I met her in Memphis, and she got me up here 6 months ago to help her get this still running for her, help her pay off her debts. Alonzo says, so I was supposed to meet her out there, and I was already getting worried because, these people she owed money to aren't the patient types. Plus, if they ever find out about us, well, wasn't for sipping the shine, I wouldn't have the nerves at all. Then I seen what they did to my angel. And Zane asks, you saw the body? Anything you can remember? And then Alonzo responds, bruh, what can I forget? She was shredded. That's the only way I can describe it, shredded. Face just wasn't one no more, and they left her clothes, but that's about it. They're animals in this country, Zane. And them woods out there, they ain't right. Whoever, whatever did this, they got to pay. Ain't no love in their hearts. And couldn't even bury her. I must have sat there an hour. I couldn't move. Then the dogs came and the sheriff with them. They didn't even fight when they took me in. That's how gone I was. Didn't see much point to it. That sheriff, he didn't care about her. He'd been in here, but all he wants to know about is his deputy again and again. Like, I care a god bit about her. Now, here, Zane, you got to do something. You got to take care of this. So that's an example of just how, I feel that Matt Jackson's writing with the narration of events going on just paints a picture. And I feel that the art was just, again, Warren Police's art, which I'll get to in just a minute, just complements that completely, though. But those words alone just paint a picture. Like, you can really see it in your head of the events just transpiring. And this is how powerful it was. So that's pretty much on Matt Johnson's writing. Right now, I'm going to get into Warren Police's art. Now, a little introduction on Warren Police. He's a British comic book artist known for his work on the DC Comics imprint Vertigo, which produced Ico Negro, and the zombie comic, A Zombie, which is an Irish novel series. His other known works include Freedom Bound and Life Sucks. So in Ico Negro, Warren Police's art is basically black and white. There's no color. And it's kind of like in a noir style. That kind of reminds me of Charlie Adlard's art from The Walking Dead. And Charlie Adlard's also another British comic book artist as well. And with Police's art, there's a mixture of action-to-action sequences along with the subject-to-subject sequences. And a good example of the subject-to-subject sequence is the train arrival, or the train ride, excuse me, to Warren or to Tupelo, Mississippi, where Zane and Carl are speaking to a white man about black people, the difference between black people in Harlem or in the North and black people in the South. And another example of the scene-to-scene sequence is the train arrival, where a poor black kid is getting bullied by a group of white men, where Zane steps in to subtly rescue the young kid who is revealed to be the son of Ryder, one of the characters that helps Zane out throughout the story. And there's a lot of action sequences, which is really common in comic books. And one notable one is when Zane is getting shot on page number 44 to 49, where he gets shot by Michaela. And this is before before he officially finds out that the woman that was shooting him was actually Michaela Mathers. In that she tells him about everything that happened. And you see a lot of sequences of him actually getting shot on the hand, and then also him running for his life as she continues shooting him. And that in a part where he sinks into where he runs into the cave where his brother and Michaela were keeping the moonshine, and he uses it to throw the moonshine at her as a grenade, because he also lights it up and then it kind of burns her, but then he saves her in the end. And there were a lot of splash pages on, there were some splash pages too on the comic too, notably on page, I believe it's page number 27. Or, yeah, it was page number 20, let's see, was it 27? It was actually on page number 23. Again, it's a splash page of the kid getting bullied. So, I mean, I did mention that as a sequence, subject to subject, but there's also a splash of that too, where it just shows him being bullied throughout. And another one, showing Michaela's corpse, or rather, Francis Jackson White's corpse, and Alonzo, Zane's brother, just standing over, you know, just kneeling over it and just grieving. So that was a pretty good splash. A sad splash, but, you know, this is a really good drawing of, like, showing, like, the emotion of it all and the sadness. And let's see, there's also another subject-to-subject sequence in which Mr. Huey arrives, and you see the train. You know, it's like a big arrival, because Mr. Huey is the main antagonist. He's the big bad, if you will. I mean, the art for me, overall, War and Peace's art did complement, it definitely did complement Matt Johnson's writing in terms of just how serious it was. And also, I think it symbolizes too, in a sense, it just symbolizes the time that it's written for, the 1930s, how it's kind of noirish, you know, the art and the writing. So they definitely go hand in hand together. And that's what creates a really good comic book. It's just that the writing and the art have to gel really well. You know, that, and so that way it just creates more of a, that's the spirit of sequential art. You know, it's just a juxtaposition between those two. You have to gel very well for the story to come out really well. Because if neither is good, then it's just, you know, it's just another picture. It's just another book with pictures and words, you know. But other than that, I really did enjoy this comic. And, I mean, this comic's art. And the amazing thing is about the art that I wanted to bring up too was just that with this comic book art, you don't really need any color to bring the story to life. You know, again, the sequential art and the writing is what helps bring the story to life. It's just like The Walking Dead. Like, you don't really need the color. Like, I think the art itself, just like Matt Jackson's, Matt Johnson's writing, Warren Police's art just brings everything to life. Like, you have an idea of, like, what's going on. You have an idea of how everything looks. And that's what makes it makes it awesome. So my final thoughts on Inca Negro is just that I read the book, and I read it many times, and I loved it. And there's a sequel being published under the Dark Horse Comics label called Inca Negro Renaissance, and that I'm going to read for the next episode. Inca Negro has got me into wanting to learn more about the Harlem Renaissance, especially the African American writers behind it, like Langston Hughes, Zora Neale, Neil Hurston, Jesse Redmond Fawcett, Claude McKay, Webb Dubois. And it's inspired me to get in touch with my African American side, which I confess I have not, you know, and just to explore that and to, yeah, just to really explore that overall.
I believe that, you know, writing, you know, just exploring the works of these writers and even works like Icon Negro can help me do that. So in closing, I just want to thank you all for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Please follow me on Twitter at BrianOfEarth16. That's my personal Twitter. You can also definitely follow the podcast's Twitter at Earth16 Podcasts. You can follow the also the podcast's Instagram on Earth16 Comics Wire and my personal Instagram at BrianOfEarth16. And I'm also going to be posting some sound bites on TikTok for you all to listen. So thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Earth16 Comics Wire. And this is Brian of Earth16. As I always say, thank you so much. And this is Brian of Earth16 signing out.